This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In law enforcement circles, a suspect's confession is known as the queen of proofs. Even when retracted, a confession usually results in a conviction because juries just can't imagine how someone could admit to doing something they didn't do.
But we're about to show you how it can and does happen. WBUR obtained video of an interrogation and confession from the Worcester Police Department. A judge ultimately threw out the confession, saying it may well have been coerced.
First, some background. 3 years ago, Ga Trang was a 16-year-old Vietnamese-American living in Worcester with her mother, who was only 14 years older than her. She was living also with her four younger brothers, whom she often cared for in her mother's stead. There was also her boyfriend and her own infant son, 13-month-old named Kyle.
On November 30th, 2008, baby Kyle stopped breathing. Na Trang called 911, but later her son was pronounced dead at the hospital. A day after the incidents, police brought Na in for questioning.
You tell us the truth, and I can guarantee you will feel better.
You didn't tell us the truth. Somebody hurt that baby. The baby didn't suffocate on the mattress. The only two people in that room, according to you and your mother, were you and Edwin. If you didn't do it, Edwin did.
More than 2 hours later, Na Trang confessed to smothering her child to death.
Now, what you just heard was an excerpt from a video recording Worcester police made of the interrogation. WBUR's David Boeri obtained the tape after months of legal wrangling. He's reporting a two-part special investigation of what happened to Na Trang. Part one aired this morning on WBUR's Morning Edition, and David joins us now. Welcome, David.
Hi, Magda.
So before we proceed, let's establish right up front that the charges against Na were dropped earlier this year. Is that right, David?
That's right. The case itself was dropped in August. Her confessions were thrown out in February, which led the case to be dropped in August.
Okay, so I have to say that I've seen all the clips that are available at WBUR.org of the video. They are stunning, and we're going to play some more of them. Each of them is about a minute long, and they're unedited here as we're playing them. So, David, let's start. Set the scene for us visually. What does the room at the Worcester PD look like, and who's in it?
It's an 8x10 room. They call it the box. It's small. It's intended to be small. It's gray. It's intended to be gray. It's close. It's there to maximize pressure on the defendant. There's a table, three chairs. On one side sits tiny Na Trang. On the other side, two 40 to 50-ish detectives.
Named?
Named Sergeant Kevin Pageo and Detective John Doherty.
Okay, so in this first clip, Na has told those officers that she found her baby with his face against the mattress. He's not breathing, and the two officers are pressing her on her story. So what you'll hear first is Sergeant Pageo asking Na, not about her son, but about one of her little brothers, because when Na was just 8 years old, so 8 years earlier, she was left alone to care for that infant brother who also died while under her care. Now, the official cause of death for her brother's death was named as SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome, and the sergeant uses that old case to assert that Na has a suspicious pattern of caring for babies who die. So let's listen to what happens.
Your brother, how did he pass away?
From sudden death syndrome.
There's no sudden death syndrome. Sudden death syndrome. How about big sister syndrome? You were watching him when he died, right? Is that not true?
Yeah.
Okay. And now you're alone with another baby and he dies? Are we going to keep doing this? Or are you going to tell me what happened?
Dad told me.
You told me what happened? His face was in the mattress? Oh, we're done here. Okay, thank you. Yeah, we're going to go now. Cut the
lying.
Then Edwin did it. One of you did it. Because that medical examiner told me that baby was smothered. Does that change your story?
Okay, David. So Edwin is the name of Na Trong's boyfriend, but the line here that catches my attention and that caught your attention was that Sergeant Pejo says the medical examiner said that young baby Kyle was smothered and that he had proof of that, but that wasn't exactly true, was it?
No. In a word, the sergeant is lying. The medical examiner had come to no findings at that point, and no one had told Sergeant Pejo that that baby was smothered. None.
So first big question that your report raises for me is it legal for police officers to essentially lie to suspects during interrogation?
One lie is not necessarily grounds for a confession to be thrown out. However, two lies is worse than one, three lies is worse than two, and the sergeant here tells multiple lies.
Okay, we're going to get to those other ones in just a second. So in this next clip, we're going to hear, as you remarked in your reporting this morning, David, the tone of the interrogation changes. The officers suddenly become really sympathetic, and they tell Na, hey, you know, it's okay, you're just a juvenile, right?
That's right. This is a technique called minimization. They tell her, her mother's really to blame. You're just a kid. The mother's to blame. Somebody else is responsible. It all kind of lowers her responsibility. And then the reward, they promise her that if she confesses to smothering her baby, they're going to get help for her and her brothers. Leniency.
Okay, so let's listen.
All everyone's waiting for today is for you to admit to what you did so that we can start the process of getting you some help, getting you into a social program, and getting your brothers out of that house and get them in a better home where there's a mom that gets up in the morning and takes care of them.
Is it okay if we talk about this next time?
Now, she is asking, is it okay if we talk about this next time, which really talks about her state of mind. She doesn't understand. This is for real. She doesn't understand that they're about to arrest her and she's in being interrogated, that she's the suspect. So she asks, can we talk next time? And there is no next time, they tell her. She is just trying to get out of there. She says she needs to attend her son's funeral. And that's when Pejo just steps it up, saying, there is no next time.
Why do you want to talk about it next time?
Because I'm telling you guys.
So what's going to change for next time? No, it goes like this. You tell us what happened. We walk right out here to Special Crimes Juvenile, get on the phone, talk to a social worker, and try to get you some help. Or you walk out of there, I call the medical examiner, get his full report, get his findings, which indicate that Kyle was strangled and on his back when it happened, and I put my case together. One of those things is going to happen today.
When you say next time, is there something you feel you have to take care of before you admit to this, or what?
I just want to get Kyle feeling this.
Okay, so that last male voice that you heard was Detective Doherty at the end. And, you know, it seems in the video, David, that he's been playing the role of good cop here. And even at the end, Na still seems to think that she can make it to her son's funeral sort of based on what he's saying. It sounds like she really doesn't understand or isn't clearly told the gravity of the situation.
No, she's clueless. The judge later says there's a quid pro quo here. She thinks that they're going to help her. She thinks that there's going to be leniency.
Well, in fact, they sort of intimate or maybe directly say that they'll help her if she confesses because, hey, they'll charge her as a juvenile.
Yeah, and then later on in that same video, they promise her outright she'll be charged as a juvenile where punishment is minimal, if any. They had no ability, no right to make that promise. In fact, afterwards, they charge her with murder as an adult.
So is that the second of the multiple knowingly false statements that they made?
And promises. False statements, as it turns out, because they don't even come clean on the quid pro quo they offer.
Okay. Well, the last bit of tape we have here is a bit faint, listeners, so I urge you to listen closely. In it, you'll hear that Na has actually, after what, more than 2 hours of interrogation?
That's right. Yes.
She's decided to confess that she suffocated her baby boy. And she actually asks the officer, do I have to say it or can I just admit that I did it? And Sergeant Pejo presses her for a few more details. And there's some really long and telling pauses in this tape in which Na hesitates for almost a minute at a time. for the sake of time, we've actually shortened those pauses a little bit, but the rest of the content is untouched. So let's listen.
You don't have to go into great detail, but what did you do?
I smothered her.
You smothered child? Now, can I ask you one more question? Do you know why you would do that?
I smothered Kyle, Nah says. So, David, that's the moment of confession. What happened next?
They actually left her in the room for 18 minutes. They come back. The first thing she says to them, are you going to take care of my brothers and I now? They say, no, we've got to take you upstairs to arrest you.
Okay. So that's David Boeri. He's going to stick with us here while we continue to talk about this in his special two-part investigative series on what looks like, or actually has been determined to be, a forced confession from out of the Worcester Police Department. And listeners, we are talking about this issue and asking some of the big questions that David's investigation raises. How reliable are confessions? And if you were on a jury, would you vote to acquit someone who confessed? And does this case serve as a lesson that maybe all interrogations should be videotaped? Have you or anyone you know been involved in a situation like this? And when you hear that audio from the interrogation of Na Trang, what do you hear and what does it make you think? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David, stick with us for just a second because I want to introduce the gentleman who's sitting next to you. He is Judge Robert Barton. He's presided on the Massachusetts Superior Court from 1978 until his retirement in 2000. And over that time, he heard approximately 150 murder cases. He's also a former criminal defense lawyer in F. Lee Bailey's law firm and was indeed a former prosecutor in the Middlesex DA's office. Judge Barton, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me first ask you, when David showed you these videos and told you about this story, what was your reaction?
Well, with every story, there's always hesitancy because there's two sides to every story, if you will. But when I viewed that videotape, I must say I was very, very upset.
Why?
For the simple reason that my understanding is that this child, Na, hadn't reached her 17th birthday. Therefore, the law was quite clear. To comply with Miranda, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court has said that essentially a parent must be present or waive their right to be present at the interrogation of a child. And whether it's one day, 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 week, if that child wasn't 17, the mother or some other adult had to be there.
So at no time should she have been alone with those officers?
There's no question about it. In fact, later on in the videotape, they allude to the fact that does your mother know you're here? And questions such as that. So they even caught on somewhere along the line.
David, let me ask you, I mean, is there any, also in the videotape, they tell her, you're a juvenile, so they clearly knew that she was underage. Why wasn't there an adult?
Well, there wasn't an adult there because the judge found it was their intent to separate her from her mother, to keep them apart, which made providing the mother a consultation, what the high court has said is the under 17 juvenile needs to have a genuine opportunity for a meaningful consultation with either a parent or a lawyer about whether or not she should waive her Miranda rights and go into that room. She never had that. Nobody got it. And they were intent on making sure her mother was out of the room, the judge said.
Mm. So, Judge Barton, in that case, how do you look upon confessions from juveniles in general? Are they always a little questionable based on the strict rules that are required when law enforcement take juveniles into custody?
Well, not really if there's compliance with the rules as far as having an adult present. But as you mentioned earlier, the confession is the coup de grace in a criminal prosecution. And yet in Massachusetts, even prior to Miranda, we had what's known as the humane practice. And the humane practice is if a confession is going to be offered against a defendant, the judge first must make a determination by himself or herself whether the statement is voluntary. Then the jury gets a second bite at it. They have to decide whether it's voluntary. Mm. So we try to protect the defendants, whether they're juveniles or not, much more in Massachusetts than in many other states.
And in fact, the state has the burden. When you take a confession to trial, the state has the burden. It has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that minor, that that person's statements were voluntary. In this case, the judge said that those statements were the product of deceit, lying, pressure, promises, the offer of leniency, and they were coercive. So the judge ruled this was a coerced confession, and therefore the defendant Na Trang's statements were involuntary and they couldn't be used.
So I've read from the Innocence Project that looks at exonerations based on DNA evidence after the fact. And they say that amongst those defendants whose guilty verdicts have been overturned based on DNA evidence, that some 25% of those defendants had either confessed to guilt, were forced to confess, or pled guilty. So I'm wondering, how common is this where someone is sitting in front of an officer and says, yeah, I did it, when they didn't really do it?
Well, you have the facts and the figures right there. I, as a judge, would never have those facts and figures. It's obvious that at least one out of four confessions end up and could end up not being truthful.
But the numbers are actually even more dramatic. Of the known cases of false confessions, an extraordinarily high preponderance of those cases are represented by two groups, juveniles and the mentally impaired, which makes the interrogation of a juvenile or somebody mentally impaired even more It requires even more care, and that is why the courts watch this carefully.
Judge Barton, let me ask you, so we wouldn't have known about this, unless David had brought it to light, but B, also if this video recording didn't exist in the first place. There's a lot to be talked about whether or not more interrogations should be videotaped, and we're going to try and touch on that in Radio Boston tomorrow. But let me ask you, the very fact that it was didn't change these officers' behavior. It seemed like they crossed the line many times anyway, even though there was a camera in the room. So
there's no question that in 2004, the state Supreme Court said that from now on, statements either will be recorded as far as voice is concerned or as far as video is concerned. And if they're not, the defendant is entitled to a charge to the jury, that the jury is to look very carefully and suspiciously upon these statements. So that's the law as of 2004, essentially. Here are these officers, and the reason for that, of course, is to make sure that these confessions are voluntary and that there isn't trickery, there isn't minimization or fraud, if you will. And it just, I just can't think of a word to describe how stupid these police officers were, very frankly. Because here they are on the videotape, and they're doing everything wrong, if you will.
David, is it stupidity, or is it just an indication on what maybe some officers think is acceptable forms of interrogation?
No. Well, first of all, not all. It becomes the camera's there. It's mounted. They don't have it beside them. They're not rolling it themselves. Sometimes they forget that it's there, and that is pretty clear. In this case, the behavior of these officers was extraordinary, and it shows that they were charging for that confession. They did not even know her age. That is what's stunning. When she says to them she's about to turn 17, they think she's about to turn 18. Mm. They don't know. They are already convinced that she's their suspect, that she committed two murders, her own son and her brother 8 years before. They've pulled records, but they haven't done basic work to know how old she was. So this, in many ways, is troubling because it seems like it's a rush to judgment. But this too is the as Judge Barton was talking about, we have confessions now that are driving the process. Juries are affected by nothing so much as they're affected by that confession. So now detectives feel driven to get those confessions.
And on that note, just in case I wasn't clear earlier when I said that 25% or one in four of people who had been found to have had a confession forced out of them, that was regarding those who were later exonerated by DNA. I just wanted to be clear in case I was confusing about that. But on the note of what David was saying, Judge Barton, does that mean, is there a possibility that now we're putting too much emphasis on getting a confession? or that confessions carry too much importance in a courtroom?
I don't think, frankly, it's either. I think that what the Supreme Judicial Court has essentially said, and there are two states that I know of that require that these statements must be recorded one way or another, is the confession should still carry the importance that it does as long as they are rightfully obtained and that they are voluntary and that there's a recording. Because even with President Nixon, you can have a tape recording, you can have an audio recording, and who knows when the camera shut off or turned on. With a video, usually there's a time and a date and whatever. With an audio, there isn't.
But it's clear, Your Honor, it's clear that she did make that statement, that she smothered Kyle. However, when that was the confession was thrown out, the DA dropped afterwards. He dropped the case because he had no physical evidence. This is what's stunning. All they had was a confession. They did not have any physical evidence. The autopsy was totally unclear. Not only it said that it was symptomatic, diagnostic of, but not exclusive to suffocation. At the same time, he had bronchitis, he had strep throat, he had a fever of 100, he had a body temperature of 101 an hour after, which said he had a fever, he had a history of respiratory problems, he had asthma, and he had a nebulizer. They had no evidence. So what's going on if you take a confession, as flimsy as that one, with no physical evidence? They had no case.
Well, the law is quite clear. You don't have a corpus delicti. You don't have a crime unless there's something that supports the confession. There has to be independent evidence that a crime took place. And as David said, there was none.
Listeners, we are talking about forced confessions and one that was brought to light through a video recording from the Worcester Police Department. David Boeri, WBUR senior reporter, has a special two-part investigation about this, and it's the case of young Na Trong, who ended up spending 2.5 years in prison before charges against her were dropped when a judge determined that her confession was forced. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can read and listen to David's report and see video of that forced confession at WBUR.org. Let's take a quick call from Brian, who's calling from Andover. You're on the air, Brian.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your thought?
I just kind of wanted to put something out there that it's all well and good to be critical of the police. You know, as it's easy for us to sit here and do that, but I think their motives were understandable, given that this woman was around, was there when another infant had died some years before. I think it's highly coincidental, it's highly suspect for this to happen yet again. And so for us to criticize the police is understandable, and to criticize the way, the methods of the confession is understandable, but I think you have to think about negligence here and think about that in addition to, you know, whether she did it on purpose.
Brian, thank you so much for your call. David, this is something that you addressed in your piece, because what's often not heard is, or can never be heard, is the voice of the victim. And officers have told you that's their job, to represent the victim.
That's right. Detectives often see themselves as being the voice of the victim. Sometimes those detectives are the only voice of the victims. However, sometimes there are no crimes. And in the end, it is the job of a detective. And it's an incredibly tough job, and I've known some terrific detectives, but in the end, the detectives are the collectors of fact. They're not the finders of fact. They're not the judge. They're not the jury, and they can't cross lines. They had a legitimate reason to be questioning that girl because of the previous death. On the other hand, what I see it as is they saw a Sid's death 8 years earlier that, by the way, had been investigated and determined to be Sid's. That made them suspicious of this one, the death of the child, and they looked at this one and it made it suspicious of that one. So you had a two-cycle engine of suspicion here.
Ellen Lincourt writes on our website, radioboston.org, or actually on WBUR.org, I should say. Since my daughter was 6 or 7, she writes, I've taught her to say two things over and over. If she's ever interrogated by the police, she's taught her to say, I want my mother and I want a lawyer. Let's get one more call in here while we have a chance. Isaac is calling from Newton. You're on the air, Isaac.
Judge Barton, Isaac Borenstein, Mr. Boeri, how are you?
Hi, Your Honor, how are you?
I'm fine. I wanted to congratulate you on having the show and just add the following perspective, that I think this what happened here on the videotape is more typical than atypical. And I actually believe these officers did not believe they were doing anything wrong, that this is part of their perspective on how to solve a crime. And they're trained to do this kind of psychological pressure. They're encouraged to do it. And I think that's one of the greatest risks obtaining wrongful convictions, that this is, in fact, encouraged as a way of drawing out admissions by defendants.
Judge Bornstein, thank you so much for your call. I hate to cut you off there, but we're just running down on time. I really appreciate you calling in. Judge Barton, your response to that?
A response is, hello, Isaac. It's great to hear from you again after all these years. I agree with you. I think there should be better training, no question about it.
And there needs to be a corrective action. What the judge says is perhaps these detectives don't understand what they're doing. However, my concern is, what actions have been taken? What actions have been taken to make sure that detectives in the Worcester Police Department know how to properly Mirandize juveniles and know how to interrogate juveniles, and they understand the rules? There always needs to be more and more training so that people don't cross the lines. Because in the end, Magda, the important thing here, and Judge Barton has made me keenly aware of it over the years, you can hit the longest baseball ever hit, but if it's 6 inches left of the left field line, it's a foul. It doesn't count. You have to stay within the rules.
David and Judge Barton, Janelle on our Facebook page wants to know something which I think a lot of listeners and even me myself want to know. Are there any consequences, or should there be any consequences, for the two officers involved in this case?
When you talk about consequences, obviously the chief of a department has to supervise his own department. I've thought about it, actually. If this child ended up spending 2 years in jail and the case is dismissed, she probably has a federal civil rights act for false arrest and accompanying problems that relate to that.
Well, we're trying to get some information to the Worcester Police Department. They will not talk to us. We want to find out if anybody has been held accountable or if any actions have been taken, and it appears the answer is no in both cases.
Well, we'll hear from Na Trong tomorrow through the second part of your reporting, David, and also she's already commented at WBUR.org on the link where your piece is contained. So listeners, if you want to see what she has to say, tune in tomorrow and go to WBUR.org today. David Boeri, senior reporter for WBUR, thank you so much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Nate.
And Judge Robert Barton presided on the Massachusetts Superior Court from 1978 until 2000. Such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much as well.
Thank you, Megan.
Well, listeners, stay with us because up next, sports with Bill Littlefield and a special remembrance of Pearl Harbor Day. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.